style revolution if we didn't chasten it proactively by ourselves. And so the fact that it's so Roosevelt that he wouldn't even mention John Brown.
And it's interesting in this list of 10, FDR wasn't mentioned, nor was World War II, nor World War I. Anyway, we are out of time. I thank the both of you. I did my best, Bridget, to get it to 10.
Lindsay, thanks for taking the time. I mean, you're at one of the most important research institutions in the world, and yet you're in front of a microphone talking to us here at the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Happy holidays, everyone. We're not done with these lists. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any show for a $12 donation, please call 701-575-0727. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.com and on Apple Podcasts. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.com. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Makoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Bach Cello Suite No. 3 in C Major by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program, Through the Eyes of Thomas Jefferson.
KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
With Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media. We discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host, editor, assistant producer, and occasional, or, you know, weekly counterfoil, is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
First story is from communityimpact.com. Missouri City renames Bedford Forest Streets due to controversy. Missouri City's City Council recently approved the name changes of two streets in the Vicksburg Village of Shiloh, a suburban neighborhood southwest of Houston, after residents protested the streets' original names due to their controversial history. The decision came after Rodney Pearson, a resident and community advocate, led a petition drive among fellow property owners to rename the streets. The streets in question, Bedford Forest Drive and Bedford Forest Court, were named after Nathan Bedford Forrest, a Confederate general during the Civil War who later became the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. Pearson's efforts were met with overwhelming support from his fellow community members. The community joined together to rally behind the initiative to change the street names to ones that better represent their aspirations and values, according to the City Council meeting statements. Council member Jeffrey Boney, who represents the area where Vicksburg Village is located, there's definitely a theme in this naming scheme, had previously initiated an ordinance amendment in 2020 lowering the threshold for name changes from 90% to 60% consent from property owners on a given street, according to city documents. This change paved the way for other homeowners in the neighborhood to successfully petition for the renaming of streets like Confederate Drive, Confederate Court, and Confederate South Drive to Prosperity Drive, Prosperity Court, and Prosperity South Drive, respectively. The lowering of the threshold to 60% for name change petitions demonstrated the council's receptiveness to the voices of the community, acknowledging the need to address historical legacies that perpetuated racial disparities and discomfort, according to Boney. The proposal to rename Bedford Forest Drive as Liberty Way Drive and Bedford Forest Court as Liberty Way Court received unanimous approval from City Council. This city council's decision was not the first of its kind, as Missouri City has previously addressed similar concerns about street names that bore connections to the Confederacy. As of July in 2020, Missouri City had 8 subdivisions and 20 street names that contained the word plantation alone, as previously reported by Community Impact. Andrew?
This change itself is symbolic, but symbols are important. They wouldn't have any meaning otherwise. What's really encouraging to me in this story is how the Missouri City City Council, it is a little fun to say, responded to the residents' opinions here and in previous instances of wanting to change their street names. Council members could have simply chosen to leave the 90% threshold as it was, but they recognized that their threshold was unusually high for other nearby cities and other cities in Texas, considered the symbolic value of and the public support for the desired name changes, and agreed to take action. That's good, responsive local governance. I hope it continues.
I also think this is a classic example of why elections matter and why voting matters. A photo of the city council that was included with the article shows that the council members appear to be majority-minority. Without elections and people exercising their constitutional right to vote, this never would have happened. This took multiple election cycles, but it happened because enough people voted. Our next story from CommunityImpact.com, Jersey Village breaks ground on $8.72 million golf course clubhouse project. Officials with the city of Jersey Village broke ground on a new clubhouse at Jersey Meadow Golf Club on July 24th to celebrate the start of construction on the $8.72 million renovation that will include converting the existing clubhouse space into an event center. It's going to be not just a resource for our golfers who are out here constantly, but it's also going to be a really great resource for the entire community. It may be a golf course clubhouse, but really, it is a clubhouse for the entire city, all of our residents, and for everyone in the area, said Mayor Bobby Warren. Now, I'm going to let this story just sit with you for a moment before we go on to the next one. Jersey Village breaks ground on $8.72 million golf course clubhouse project. Just take a breath. Okay, the next story from CNN.com, why America stopped building public pools. Louisville's public parks were desegregated in 1955, a year before Jerome Sutton, now 66, was born. This included the newly built Algonquin Outdoor Swimming Pool on the west side of Louisville. It cost 35 cents to swim in Algonquin at the time, Sutton said, which is about $4 today. He and his 7 siblings took turns going on alternating weekends because the family could not afford to send all 8 children at the same time. Public pools have played a critical role in American culture over the past century, but as climate change and extreme heat worsen, they are taking on an urgent public health role. Heat kills more Americans than any other weather-related disaster, according to data tracked by the National Weather Service. Yet, just as public pools become more important than ever, they're disappearing from sight. In the early 2000s, Louisville had 10 public pools for a population of around 550,000. Today, the city has 5 public pools for a population of around 640,000. Algonquin is the only pool left in West Louisville, and residents say the city has neglected basic maintenance and improvements for years. This summer, as temperatures climb to the 90s in Louisville, Algonquin is closed for repairs, leaving around 60,000 people, most of whom are black and middle or lower income households, without convenient access to the water. Some will miss out on a chance to learn how to swim or get more comfortable in the water and build life-saving skills. Kids and teens won't have a key place to gather and play during the summer months when school is off. And senior-aged people, that is to say, can't participate in Aquazumba fitness classes held at Algonquin during the summer to help them stay active. Said Louisville Councilwoman Tammy Hawkins, who represents the district, swimming is mental health. It's therapy. You have to have activities. It's bigger than just a pool. Access to swimming pools has long been hotly contested in America. Giant municipal pools were built in the first half of the 20th century, and desegregating public pools was a key target of the civil rights movement. But, strapped for funding, many local governments have neglected public pools. The retreat of government and the privatization of swimming pools and recreation has hurt poor and minority groups the hardest, historians and public recreation experts say. Today, 79% of children and families with household incomes less than $50,000 have no or low swimming ability, according to a 2018 study. 64% of black children, 45% of Hispanic children, and 40% of white children have no or low swimming ability, the study found. While public pools are a rarer sight today, governments built enormous pools during the 20th century. The New Deal led to the biggest burst of public pools in American history. The federal government built nearly 750 pools and remodeled hundreds more between 1933 and 1938. A 1933 survey of Americans' leisure activities found that as many people swam frequently as went to the movies before television, so like so few options. Before the 1920s, swimming pools in the North were segregated along gender lines, but not racial lines. This changed as they became gender integrated. Racial stereotypes around cleanliness and safety, as well as intense fears of black men interacting with white women in bathing suits, turned pools into some of the most segregated public spaces in America, said Victoria Wolcott, a historian at the University of Buffalo and author of Race, Riots, and Roller Coasters, The Struggle Over Segregated Recreation in America. Wolcott said that in the late 1940s, there were major swimming pool riots over the integration in St. Louis, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles. Gaining entry to swimming pools was a top priority for civil rights groups who saw recreation as a fundamental human right. In Martin Luther King's 1963 letter from a Birmingham jail, he described the tears in his daughter's eyes when, quote, she is told that Funtown is closed to colored children. But the success of the civil rights movement integrating pools coincided with a surge of private pools and swim clubs. Millions of middle-class white families left cities for the suburbs and built pools in their new backyards during the era. New suburbanites chose to organize country clubs with fees rather than build pools open to the public. From 1950 to 1962, 22,000 private swim clubs opened, mostly in white suburbs. Some parts of the South revolted against integration by paving over or draining their pools rather than integrating them. Of the public pools open in 1961 in Mississippi, for example, nearly half had closed 11 years later by 1972. As whites withdrew from public pools and parks, taxpayer funding and support for pools dwindled. In Cleveland, the city's recreation budget was cut by 80%. Parks and recreation agencies tend to be the first area to cut when budgets are tight and the slowest to get money back, said Kevin Roth, Vice President of Research, Evaluation, and Technology at the National Recreation and Park Association. Public pools are costly for cities to maintain and insure. Cities also have struggled to staff pools with lifeguards. High school and college students have more summer job options and are less likely to pick up a job as a lifeguard over the summer than they once did, he said. To give people in West Louisville a place to swim this summer, the city approved $100,000 in funding for free summer passes to the YMCA and an amusement park. Passes will only be available to a limited number of residents, and many residents lack transportation to get to the YMCA amusement park. Louisville's metro government has allocated $6 million to renovate Algonquin and another pool, but some local residents and leaders say renovating the Algonquin pool is not enough. They want an indoor swimming pool, open all year, like the aquatic center on the predominantly white east side of the city, so people can access the water and take classes and stay fit. I would love for it to be year-round with water safety classes, said LaShondra Logan, 35, who grew up in West Louisville and has gone to Algonquin since she was a child. Last year, she learned how to swim through a local nonprofit group, Central Adult Learn to Swim. 87% of the program students are black and 85% are women. She is currently enrolled in a lifeguard instruction class and wants to help other people in the community learn how to swim. Currently, there is a 2,500-person waitlist for adults in Louisville who want to learn to swim through the nonprofit. It's a life-changing experience, Logan said. So, Andrew, thoughts?
Yes, this is another instance of race impacting an aspect of U.S. public policy that many people wouldn't expect. Swimming pools are just one kind of public amenity that aren't maintained well or just closed down in predominantly black neighborhoods. Schools are talked about often, but hospitals are affected too. Public park space is sold for new development as well, all because these positive, community-focused amenities cost money to build and maintain. And while the quality of life they bring is considered worth it for white neighborhoods, most U.S. public policy was written when the quality of black life was an obstacle to exploitation more than anything else. Police departments and prisons, though, provided the threat of force, a threat often made good on, to keep black people in line and exploitable. That was considered worth the expense because it often meant that the local and national leaders would have ample opportunity to use black labor in their own businesses to line their own pockets. Fast forward a few decades without a thorough rewrite of the policy, and these ideas are still, unfortunately, present in our laws and in our concepts of civics today. So yes, there should be more swimming pools and parks and schools and hospitals in black neighborhoods, and the ones already there should get more of the funding from the amenities that are doing just fine. And more funding generally should go towards quality of life instead of threat of force. But as long as we keep addressing these issues as they pop up, we will continue to be surprised by them. Addressing them one by one does move us inch by inch to a more equitable system, but to truly get there will require something more.
Not directly addressing the story, but I wasn't sure exactly how to approach this, so I kind of went back to my recollections. When I was little, we never went to a public pool that I recall, although I remember many trips to Jones Beach in Nassau County. When I was small, we were living on Ocean Avenue and Quentin Road, which is kind of in southern, westernish Brooklyn, urban area. If anyone's familiar with Brooklyn, King's Highway was very, very close, major road. I know that my mom at the time was deathly afraid of polio in those days, and she feared public pools might be a source. And I know that that's the fact because she not only told me that, but she also emphatically, and I can tell you a story where she really scared the you-know-what out of me because she ran out the door like, "What are you doing?" And basically, she wouldn't let me share glasses or containers or share a soda with anybody because this was in the days before a polio vaccine. Polio vaccines were not widely available until about 1955 or so, and I was born in 51. So just before I turned 5 years old, we moved to a new middle-class neighborhood in southeast Brooklyn called Seaview Village. That was in December of 55. I was still basically four. And not too many years after that, my family joined, and here's where it gets into context, a newly built club called the Seaview Pool and Yacht Club. Now, I always wondered where the yachts were because there weren't even rowboats to rent, but the name sounded grand, I guess. Because we never went to a public pool, I never connected with anything special until I read – or connected that with anything special until I read this story, and it made me question my memories and my understanding of my memories. Now, I have no idea what it costs to join the Seaview Pool and Yacht Club, but I suspect my mom's parents paid for it because we were not that well off. I know that not everyone in our predominantly Jewish and Italian neighborhood could afford it. I really have nothing really to add to this beyond what I've said and what Andrew said, except that I wish my parents were still around so I could discuss this story with them and kind of try to put my head where theirs was at the time. Okay. Time for a quick break, and then we get to more Texas fascism. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM, HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. and re-airing Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org, on Google Podcasts, which can be downloaded from both the Android or iPhone app stores, or by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. We heavily excerpt every story, so I link to full articles. I should say almost every story. So I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Click the Show Posts and More tab at the top of the webpage and find the post for the show or show date you're looking for. Recent shows are at the top. Shows and articles go back to May 2010, so you can also type keywords into the search bar. Shows are about 80% scripted and about 20% extemporaneous, so you can visually scan an episode's text if there is one particular topic in which you might be interested without necessarily having to listen through the whole audio. We are on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig, and look for me on Threads and Twitter at ThinkWing Radio, plus Andrew has his own accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's Dominate, E-Y-E, on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
You know, I've been doing ThinkWing Radio on KPFT now for, it'll be 10 years in the middle of December. And I think that I've probably, I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
That was just, wow. 10 years, yeah.
Yeah, 10 years. So it's 9.5 years now. It'll be, I think, December 13th kind of is the 10-year anniversary. And I have a suspicion that what I say, how I say it, my overall presentation has probably evolved quite a bit in the last 9.5 years.
Yeah.
And I say that because of where we're going to be going after this next story, which I was actually alerted to when I got Egberto Willi's nightly email, or morningly email, depends on your point of view. This is from the Texas Tribune. Texas A&M suspended professor accused of criticizing Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick in lecture. The professor, an expert on the opioids crisis, was placed on paid administrative leave and investigated, raising questions about the extent of political interference in higher education, particularly in health-related matters. And the story goes on to say, Joy Alonzo, a respected opioid expert, was in a panic. The Texas A&M University professor had just returned home, presumably to College Station or thereabouts, from giving a routine lecture on the opioid crisis at the University of Texas Medical Branch in March. I believe it's the medical branch in Galveston, from what the story says further on. When she learned a student at that lecture had accused her of disparaging Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick during the talk. Disparaging, apparently. In the few hours it took to drive from Galveston, the complaint had made its way to her supervisors, and Alonzo's job was suddenly at risk. Not only were her A&M supervisors involved, but so was Chancellor John Sharp, a former state controller, comptroller, who now holds the highest-ranking position in the Texas A&M university system, which includes 11 public universities and 153,000 students. And Sharp was communicating directly with the lieutenant governor's office about the incident, promising swift action. Less than 2 hours after the lecture ended, Patrick's chief of staff had sent Sharp a link to Alonzo's professional bio. Shortly after, Sharp sent a text directly to the lieutenant governor saying, Joy Alonzo has been placed on administrative leave pending investigation, Ray firing her. Should be finished by end of week. The text message was signed J. Sharp. For free speech advocates, health experts, and students, Texas A&M's investigation of Alonzo was a shocking demonstration of how quickly university leaders allow politicians to interfere in classroom discussions on topics in which they are not experts, and another example of increasing political involvement from state leaders in how Texas universities are managed. The revelation comes as Texas A&M is still reeling over concerns that the university allowed politically motivated outsiders to derail the hiring of Kathleen McElroy, a black journalism professor at the University of Texas at Austin, to revive the journalism school at Texas A&M. The subsequent outcry over how Texas A&M handled the situation prompted the university president to resign last week, and the interim dean of arts and sciences stepped down from that role but will remain a professor. In an email obtained by the Texas Tribune through a public records request, Alonzo told Chandler Self, the UTMB professor who invited her to speak there, that the investigation had been kicked off by a student, quote, who has ties to Texas A&M leadership. The Texas A&M system confirmed the series of phone calls and text messages that led to Alonzo's investigation was kicked off by Texas Land Commissioner Dawn Buckingham, a graduate of UTMB's medical school. The Tribune confirmed her daughter, a first-year medical student at the time, attended Alonzo's lecture. Buckingham served 6 years in the Texas Senate with Patrick, who endorsed her run for land commissioner last year, and she recently attended Sharp's wedding in May. Buckingham declined to comment. Ultimately, Texas A&M allowed Alonzo to keep her job after an internal investigation could not confirm any wrongdoing. Dan Patrick did not respond to a request for comment. Adam Steinbow, an attorney with the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, a nonprofit legal group focused on protecting free speech on college campuses, said, quote, "It would be highly inappropriate for a university to conduct an investigation if a faculty member says something critical of a state leader or a government official. That is, I think," he said, "a misuse of institutional resources, and it's one that will have a chilling effect, and that has a chilling effect, even if you wind up clearing the professor," Steinbaugh said. This article is a lot longer, but I think this is the core of the story. This last couple of weeks has not been a good look for Texas A&M or for Texas. 2 weeks ago, I went on a rant about how the Republican Party is beginning to look a lot like fascists. That's not as good as looking a lot like Christmas, by the way. So let's go down a list in no particular order. Banning books? Check. Exercising increasing state control over public speech? Check. Chilling expression in schools and universities? Check. Oppressing vulnerable minorities? Check. Coddling racists and Christian nationalists? Check. Government working hand in glove with business as long as government calls the shots? Check. Voter suppression to enable minority rule? Check. Ordering Texas National Guard to push illegal migrants back into the Rio Grande? Close enough, but check. Be afraid. Andrew?
Texas's crackdown on universities continues to cause concern. If nothing else, these stories highlight the dangers of allowing public university leadership to be gubernatorial appointees. It might be better to have university leaders appointed by panels of leaders from the community that the university serves, perhaps including city and county representatives, as well as state and federal legislators representing the university's district. That way, university leaders are more likely to reflect the culture that the university is part of, instead of the whims of whoever the governor is.
Okay, I'm going to do an early break to make room for my rant warning.
Yeah.
Red flag going up. Just be prepared. Okay, this is Thinkwing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central Time and re-airing Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org, on Google Podcasts, which can be downloaded from both the Android or iPhone app stores, or by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. KPFT is Houston's community media and broadcasts about 100 show titles. To do that means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming. You can show your support for Thinkwing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick your favorite show, Thinkwing Radio, perhaps, and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, and you may qualify for a lovely thank you gift. Just ask and tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows, because spreading the word helps us too, and it's free. And in this particular moment, I would like to thank Robert Mark for sending a donation to support Thinkwing Radio and KPFT. It is very much appreciated, Robert. And, you know, just thank you very much is about all I can say.
Yes, thank you for helping to keep, I think, one of the bastions of free speech radio in Houston on the air.
And the most conservative liberal on the station on the air. So there's also that.
And a socialist on the air.
Yes. Although I have to say, I have to say objectively, I am getting rather more hyperbolic than most centrists would be.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that means necessarily. I don't know that my views are, well, I mean, everyone's views evolves. Mm. I think I'm just maybe getting, in a subconscious way, a little more politically panicky.
Well, if you at home want to see how Mike's journey goes from here, do donate to KPFT or Thinkwing Radio.
Yeah, keep us on, because they're quarterly reviews, and you never know. Mm. Okay, WashingtonPost.com. And actually, this story was superseded by a later story from the New York Times, but I didn't see any reason to change my source because I didn't think that much had changed in the story. Still essentially the same. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy floats an impeachment inquiry into President Joe Biden. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says Republican lawmakers may consider an impeachment inquiry of President Joe Biden over unproven claims of financial misconduct, responding to enormous GOP pressure to demonstrate support for Donald Trump ahead of the 2024 presidential election. Because impeaching a president to show support for a prospective president, yeah, I mean, that's how you show support. You see, I think showing support is donating money to KPFT. But be that as it may. In remarks Tuesday at the Capitol, McCarthy said the questions of House Republicans are raising about the Biden family finances need to be investigated. So far, McCarthy acknowledged, the House's probes have not proven any wrongdoing. But an impeachment inquiry, quote, allows Congress to get the information to be able to know the truth. An impeachment inquiry by the House would be a first step toward bringing articles of impeachment. Such a probe could be as lengthy or swift as the House determines, potentially stretching into the campaign season. We will follow this to the end, he said, first floating the idea late Monday on Fox News. In the strongest comment yet from McCarthy on a potential Biden impeachment after the Republican leader sidelined earlier efforts by House conservatives to launch such an inquiry. With a slim majority in the House, McCarthy faces demands from Trump allies to elevate their priorities. Trump himself questioned at a Fox News town hall last week why Biden has not yet been impeached. McCarthy has not yet endorsed Trump, who is the early Republican frontrunner for president, or any other GOP candidates. He denied a report that he is considering House votes to expunge Trump's two impeachments as another way of showing support. McCarthy on Tuesday gave no timeline for launching an impeachment inquiry into Biden and said he hadn't spoken to Trump about it. He declined to say if he would be making a presidential endorsement. The story is somewhat longer. This is just the first several paragraphs. Following is my opinion on this effort and the history that contextualizes it as I see it. This story, for me, is just another example of Republican partisans using impeachment as a political weapon rather than as a tool of political justice. I've always believed that 24 years after Watergate, the Republicans impeached President Bill Clinton in 1998 out of revenge for Nixon. Given the slim pretexts, I viewed this at the time as an attempted legal coup. In an effort to break this cycle in 2006, and of course this is my interpretation of history, the then incoming Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced that impeachment of George W. Bush was off the table. A lot of Democrats howled about that. I've long believed that this was the equivalent of a bid in bridge. Basically, we pushed Nixon from office. You had your shot at Bill Clinton. Let's call it even. This was in spite of the fact that there were very strong political reasons to impeach Bush related to lying us into the Second Iraq War, and a desire to do so was very strong among Democrats at the time. Pelosi resisted this pressure from within her caucus. Fringe Republicans responded to this olive branch during the Obama administration by constantly trying to round up votes to impeach President Barack Obama for something or other. No one really knew. Then the Democrats impeached Donald Trump twice. Initially, Nancy Pelosi resisted impeaching for reasons including national political divisions and restarting a cycle of revenge impeachment by Republicans. Finally, though, political pressure and reasons too powerful to ignore pushed her toward the first impeachment vote on December 18, 2019, for essentially trying to extort Ukraine into announcing a corruption investigation into then-Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden. Trump was eventually acquitted because the Senate could not muster the necessary two-thirds vote to convict. In the Republican-controlled Senate, no Republican voted to convict. Trump was then impeached again on January 19, 2021, for incitement of insurrection, with all Democrats and 10 Republicans voting to impeach in the House for his alleged roles in the January 6th invasion of the Capitol during the congressional count of electoral votes. He was acquitted again for lack of a two-third Senate vote to convict, but this time, in the Democrat-controlled Senate, there were 57 Senate votes to convict, including 7 Republicans and 2 independents. Now, referring back to our story of the moment, fringe Republicans are again at the impeachment revenge game, but this time with much less pushback from the House Speaker Representative Kevin McCarthy. This attempt at a revenge impeachment is different, though, from efforts to impeach Clinton and Obama. This is an effort from a Republican Party and many of its elected officials who participated in efforts to subvert the electoral vote count with fake elector slates, efforts to subvert the counting of the electoral vote with violence, efforts to subvert the electoral vote with meritless objections during the process, and with those who are possibly under investigation for complicity in the planning and execution of various attempts to subvert the electoral voting process, either by scheming or by violence. The current era of fierce political antagonism was inaugurated by Newt Gingrich, considered the effective author of the Clinton impeachment. But we are now confronting a Republican Party that goes far beyond so-called political puffery. Republican officials make comments that a reasonable person might consider to be lies. Incitement to violence based on politics, race, or culture. Passive or active endorsements of white supremacy and Christian nationalism. Passive or active support of Russian President Vladimir Putin in his invasion of Ukraine. Apparent desire and or efforts to subvert democracy in favor of political and corporate autocracy. Even what might be called fascism. This is not your grandfather's Republican Party, and maybe not even your father's. But, and this is entirely my personal opinion of party officials and operatives and not Republicans en masse, the Republican Party today is showing many signs of being a party of political subversion and suppression on a scale that might be considered racketeering or at least conspiracy, perhaps both. In 2018, the political party was released. Not many people remember this, but you know, you have to be old. In 2018, the Republican Party was released from a consent decree. And this is how it's explained. The consent decree, entered on November 1st, 1982, prevented the Republican Party from engaging in activities that suppress the vote, particularly when it comes to minority voters. It also barred the wearing of armbands at polling places. Unquote. In the absence of any legal constraints since 2018, the Republicans are back up to their dirty tricks, but now they're actually anti-democracy. Have you ever heard of, this is Andrews, and this is actually a terrific comment from him, and I guess I was thinking of stealing it, but nah. Go ahead, Andrew. You say you.
All right, well, I'll leave that in the edit because of the compliment. Have you, Mike, ever heard of the paradox of tolerance?
I have not.
Well, for the unfamiliar, this is the idea that in order to remain tolerant, a tolerant society must be intolerant of intolerance, thus compromising its status as a tolerant society. I think the Republican Party is very much an intolerant group and is exploiting the claims of tolerance that the U.S. electoral system relies upon to shield themselves from consequences for their intolerant and destructive campaign. I actually ran across a good argument for a solution to the paradox of tolerance recently. A tolerant society has a social contract that establishes mutual tolerance between its members. Intolerant people and groups break that contract, and thus they lose the tolerance they would be entitled to under that contract if they followed it. This, I believe, is how we should look at the Republican Party. They are trying to use force and manipulation to undermine the U.S. electoral system, and so they should no longer be afforded what rights and protections exist under it. The problem, unfortunately, is that the Democrats are the only other group in the system that could enforce that consequence on the Republicans, and the Democrats don't have enough of an edge over the Republicans to enforce that consequence. The downsides of a two-party system. Perhaps it's time for the Democrats to help open the system to some of the minor players so they can take the Republicans down together.
Well, of course, the paradox of our system becoming a multi-party system is that the largest minority would win as opposed to the majority. In parliamentary systems, this sometimes ends poorly with coalitions of the extremes to govern.
I do just have to say...
Yes,
I think
go
we
ahead.
Do already. I think we do already have a coalition of the extremes, and I think it's called the Republican Party. I respect your analysis, but I think that the two-party system is no longer protecting us from anything.
Well, of course, the point that I make about minority parties running for president is precisely that what they do is they disrupt the electoral system, which is not a majority rules system for president, and it just means that the largest minority winner wins. I think one of the most startling things that I had experienced in decades was, I believe it was Obama, won with over 50% of the vote?
The popular vote? I don't remember.
I think it was, because there was not a significant third party running and there were no really effective spoilers. And I think if my memory is correct, and I think it was Obama, certainly I don't believe it was Biden, but I believe it was Obama won with over 50% of the vote, and I literally could not remember the last time a president had been elected with over 50% of the vote. It seemed like for like the latter half of the 20th century, there had always been a third party spoiler that got at least a couple of percentage points, which is very often the spread between a winner and a loser.
Okay, I did look this up. And in the 2008 presidential election, Barack Obama won with 52.9% of the popular
vote. Yeah, that was amazing. I mean, I think Clinton won with like 49% and then with like, I don't know if he ever won with 50%. Of course, Nixon won with a landslide because he was running against an incredibly weak candidate in 1968 because Johnson had withdrawn. Robert Kennedy, as soon as Robert Kennedy entered the race, Nixon was going to win, whether Kennedy was assassinated or not. Because when a strong candidate runs against a sitting president, that president is going to lose.
Well, I'll say, yeah, I can understand the criticism. I think it's more of the fault of the system for not, you know, allowing third-party candidates than it is third-party candidates running, because it's one of the only ways they can secure national funding and these sorts of things. But I think we agree that the current system is not ideal, and that ranked choice voting, couldn't think of it. That's weird.
Yeah.
That's concerning. Ranked choice voting.
You're getting old, man. You're in your mid-20s.
Oh, God, yeah.
It's all downhill.
It's all downhill. Anyway.
Well, I think the point we absolutely agree on is I have no problem with minority parties running and contributing their ideas as long as we have a ranked choice voting system. And this goes for eliminating the Electoral College as well, because the only way that'll work.
Yeah.
A ranked choice voting system, as many contenders as you want, and eventually someone gets 50% plus one.
Yes.
And to me, that is the only way to have legitimacy in government.
Yes.
And absolutely. As we have seen, if a minority party or a minority presidential candidate, as it were, had to form a coalition with a number of weaker parties, usually if it's a leftist party to the left, a rightist party to the right, that basically it kind of makes inevitable having increasingly extreme governments with minority losers or minority winners, rather.
I don't think I have the time or brain power to process that.
Yeah,
I'm not going to. I'm gonna warn that, to attach a warning label to that. So anyway.
Now I'm also gonna say that at the end of this story, I have an uncommon number of reference links to save folks the initial effort of having to do searches. So I'll just give you a quick list. I have from the impeachment of Bill Clinton from Wikipedia, efforts to impeach Barack Obama from Wikipedia, McCarthy floats impeachment into Garland over the DOJ weaponization from The Hill, inside the House GOP's plan to go after the FBI and DOJ from Politico.com, Pelosi, Bush impeachment off the table from 2006, first impeachment of Donald Trump, Wikipedia, second impeachment of Donald Trump, Wikipedia. I've also included a definition of puffery versus fraud on the political campaign trail, since I used the word. I thought it's only fair. And another reference from the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Justice Programs discussing state and local governments' use of the treble damages remedy under civil RICO, in other words, Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, as a means of redressing the economic effects of unlawful conduct. Because RICO used to mean like, you know, money rackets, like protection rackets. And now it's also applied to things like political grift and graft rackets, if that's not a weird way of putting it.
It's essentially, it's used in a lot of cases where it's just organized crime, generally.
Organized crime even among politicians.
Yes.
The definition of organized crime and racketeering in politicians has slowly been legally expanded. And then there's also the reference from Politico, judge ends consent decree limiting RNC ballot security activity. So if you want to dig into it, I've tried to give you a head start.
Yeah, there are a number of references for this story. There are a number of inline references on my comments. So we both, I think, suggest that you go to the blog at thinkwingradio.com/posts-page and check out the blog post for this show, because there's a lot of good info there.
Yeah, well, there's always a lot of good
info there. There's always a lot of good info there.
But admittedly, Some shows are better than others. They can't all be equal. They can only have equal opportunity.
Mm.
Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. CT and airing again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org by downloading it with Google Podcasts, available from both the Android and iPhone app stores, or by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous versions of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. We do heavily excerpt most, if not all, shows, stories on the show, rather, which is why we include links to full articles on the show posts and more page at thinkwingradio.com. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, keep up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738 extension 1. That's 713-526-KPFT extension 1. Now, I am not sure how Robert Mark decided to make his donation to KPFT and Think Wing Radio, whether he went to the site and clicked the donate button or whether he called the extension. But we thank you, Robert, and we hope you set an example for many more. And you can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We're also on Facebook at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. I am on Threads and Twitter at Think Wing Radio, and Andrew has his own accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
The next story is from TheGuardian.com. It's called, and this is, I guess, along the lines of the previous impeach, impeach, everybody impeach. Along those lines, there's the story, Anger and Radicalization, Rising Number of Americans Say Political Violence is Justified. Survey shows a small but significant share of Americans believe in use of force to attain political goals on both the left and right. The June federal indictment of Donald Trump is radicalizing support for the use of force on behalf of the former president and current presidential candidate, according to the author of a recent survey about threats to democracy. Meanwhile, on the other side of the aisle, support for violence to restore the federal right to an abortion has also increased over the last few months, researchers found, although there's little indication that any organized groups support acting on this belief. The Dangers to Democracy report indicates that a growing number of Americans support the use of political violence as the 2024 presidential campaign heats up and further indictments of Trump are probably imminent. Said Robert Pape, a University of Chicago professor who led the research, the indictment is radicalizing support for Trump, but that's not the only source of radicalization. You're seeing growing anger and radicalization on the left as well. The number of Americans who believe the use of force is justified to restore Trump to the White House increased by roughly 6 million in the last months to an estimated 18 million people, according to the survey conducted by the university in late June and shared exclusively with The Guardian. Of those 18 million people, 68% believe the 2020 election was stolen from Trump, and 62% believe the prosecutions of Trump are intended to hurt his chances in 2024. An estimated 7% of Americans now believe violence could be necessary to restore Trump to the presidency, up from just 4.5% or 12 million people in April. Now, let's keep in context about 350 million Americans of all ages. But over the same period, Trump's general favorability slightly decreased among Republicans, the survey found. The university's Chicago Project on Security and Threats by CPOST, or called CPOST, research center has been conducting dangers of democracy surveys of American adults on political violence and attitudes toward democracy since shortly after the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Maybe not the best starting point to get a context. But going on, the most recent report marks the first increase in radical violence support for Trump since April of 2022, according to Pape, who directs CPOST. The public is more radicalized than it was in April, and that's really quite significant, he said. We've been tracking this quite a while, and this is a really big bump. Still, a radicalized public isn't enough for actual violence to occur, Pape said. He compared the support to kindling, but said Trump would have to give a speech or rally inciting people to act at a certain time to light the fire, as he did in Washington, D.C. on 6 January of 21. Democrats, however, expressed support for political violence for a different purpose. The survey found support for the use of force to coerce members of Congress to, quote, do the right thing, grew from 9% in January to 17%, an estimated 44 million Americans, at the end of June, with the sharpest rise among Democrats. Support for violence to restore the federal right to an abortion also increased during this time. Pape said the things are definitely heading in the wrong direction in terms of radicalization of the country, and we need to be aware of that because there were some hopes that the Trump indictment would actually reduce support for Trump, he said. Survey respondents also said they view Trump as a bigger threat to democracy than President Joe Biden, with a difference of 52% to 33%. Researchers also asked participants about support for dangerous conspiracy theories, including whether they believe that a secret group of Satan-worshipping pedophiles is ruling the U.S. government. The number of people who believe that statement, a major tenet of the QAnon conspiracy theory, increased slightly, although the change was not greater than the margin of error. The survey also found that nearly 90% of Trump's most radical supporters believe the federal government is run by a deep state of immoral people. With more indictments of Trump likely to come in the next few weeks, both from the federal government and the Fulton County, Georgia district attorney, Pape said he was concerned that further radicalization of the public is likely to occur. As Trump faces more complicated legal trouble and the 2024 election season gets underway with the first GOP debate just 1 month away, the number of Americans who believe that the 2020 election was stolen from them remains largely unchanged at roughly 20%. Things are going in the wrong direction of radicalization, and we haven't even gotten into the really heated part of the 24 election season, Pape said. I want to point out that this article actually comes with a number of charts and graphs. The one, I'm afraid I can't include it in the blog post, but you can click on the link to the story to find all of them. It says, political actions that a minority of Americans believe justify the use of force. And this is about seven of them. Protect the voting rights of Black Americans and other minorities, 18.6%. Ensure members of Congress and other government officials do the right thing, and there's a slippery phrase, 17.3%. Restore the federal right to abortion, 12.3%. Prevent President Donald Trump from becoming president, 11.6%. Prevent the teaching of CRT in schools, 9.3%.
CRT being critical race theory.
Critical race theory as opposed to cathode ray tube. Prevent the teaching of CRT in schools, 9.3%. Preserve the rights of whites, 8.5%. And prevent prosecution of Trump, 7%. So those groups in varying degrees and percentages think that to some degree, in some cases, violence is justified. Now, to my mind, these are somewhat concerning numbers, but not yet very scary numbers. The trajectory is certainly something to worry about. I felt for a long time that there have always been extremists of varying flavors at about 20% at each end of the population. At either end, they would be happy, I believe, to vote for communists or fascists, depending on which end. The purpose of a functioning democracy, to me, is to provide a safety valve for activism, expressionism, and to some extent, representation of diverse views, even extreme views. I believe that violence is more likely to occur when views are silenced and repressed, and those who have those views feel hopeless. In addition, in discussions with conservatives, I've occasionally used the argument that a social safety net for the poor is life insurance for the rich. People won't just starve and die while living under bridges and overpasses simply because some wealthy elite thinks they must deserve it. Those are the sources of violence and rebellion a la Marie Antoinette. So if the rich people value their property and value their lives, they should absolutely gladly advocate and pay taxes to help the poor to survive, to thrive, and to find increased prosperity. I think something very important.
Again, I'm honored a second time that you've taken my words right out of my mouth.
Have I literally? Oh, did
yes.
I start to do that?
You started to do that. Okay.
I guess I'm just growing extremely fond of your words.
I suppose so.
It is like the ultimate compliment from someone so far to the right of you.
I will take it. Okay.
Go ahead. Andrew, please.
Thank you. regarding this story, I think something very important to consider that isn't mentioned here is that democracy is not an absence of political violence. It is a redirection of that violence. When a state passes laws and sets consequences for breaking them, that is a threat of violence for political purposes. When that state instructs police to enforce those consequences, that is an act of violence for political purposes. We see this even in nations that are considered pinnacles of democracy. Ergo, political violence does not prevent democracy from functioning. I would argue that, in fact, violence can, in itself, be a form of democracy. Consider the founding of the United States of America, a violent revolution where a numerically superior settler force overpowered a smaller force representing the English crown. While revolution is not always a true expression of popular will, see any of the various military coups in history, when it is led by a majority of the common people, it is as legitimate as any election or referendum. But just because it's legitimate doesn't mean it's beneficial. This will be subjective and driven by my own biases, but I believe the left-wing motivators for violence in the poll above from this article are on the whole good things. They are in service of expanding and defending every individual's own freedom and control over their own body and voice in politics. Every person benefits from those aims. In contrast, the right-wing motivators are about elevating white people above everyone else, suppressing the reality of racial oppression in the U.S., and enabling further limitations on majority freedom for the sake of enriching a minority of people. Very few people benefit from these aims. Considering that democracy is about majority rule, I would call the left-wing aims, which benefit the majority of people, more compatible with democracy as an ideal, and thus better. Now, obviously, no form of violence is nice, and nonviolent solutions allow more views to be represented more honestly, as well as just keeping more people alive and able to contribute to a society's common welfare. Democracy built upon indirect violence does certainly still have value, but I would not call political violence a threat to democracy so much as a less than ideal form of it. Deciding whether a particular example of political violence is good or not is subjective, but I believe it largely depends on the old standby: who benefits?
I actually thought that that was very well said.
Why, thank you.
And I think we're more or less at the end of the show.
Yeah, I think so, too. I don't know whether, you know, you have any more specific comments just to bring us home, but...
I think, you know, I have a couple of formulas. I have my 30-40-30 formula. I have my 40-20-40 formula. My 40-20-40... is that about 40% of the population that votes will probably vote Republican, and about 40% will probably vote Democrat. And then you've got the 20%, which divides four ways. 5% of that 20 leans Republican, 5% of that 20 leans Democrat, and it's really the 10% in the middle who just don't know who the heck they can vote for that comes closest to fulfilling their values, which is why I think most elections are within that 10% spread, because those are really the votes that are in flux.
And those are general numbers, because that doesn't take into account third-party voters. But
that is based on the premise that 90% of all statistics are made up.
Yes.
So going forward again, so now I also have what I call my 30-40-30 ratio, which is about 30% of voters would, with varying degrees of enthusiasm, vote for a communist government if it was put forward. And about 30% of voters would be brought along, could be brought along to vote for a fascist government. And that's 60%. So now you've got the 40% who are going to make that difference. So that 40% in the middle is really the group that's keeping the democracy on a sane path.
Subjectively sane, but okay.
Subjectively sane, and 90% of all statistics are made up. But I have watched enough elections to see this kind of pattern really sort of repeated frequently. So I have a certain degree of confidence in it. In any case, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on Houston's Community Media, 90.1 FM HD2 KPFT. My co-host, indispensable editor, and co-producer is Andrew Ferguson. We hope you've enjoyed the show and found it interesting, and look forward to sharing this time with you again next week. Y'all take care.
See you later.
Let's keep on looking for the the morning after. It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe?